It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the own and only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.
Welcome back to the Leading LDS Podcast. My name is Kurt Frankham, and it is time that we delve deeper into the leadership world and understand how on earth we can be better leaders in the church. And before we get started into the topic of this article and post, I want to spend some time with some comments I've received through the website, some really good positive ones, and I thought they'd be worth sharing. And many of you know I put out a teaching help post for each lesson in the Ezra-Taft Benson manual. If you're not aware of this, please check them out or sign up for the newsletter. I send out information that way about these. But basically, I want to put out information for instructors to hopefully give a better lesson. And this isn't necessarily, you know, doctrinal help or scriptures you can read. This is mainly more in presentation, how to effectively engage the class. Here's some ideas for maybe an attention activity or different ways to discuss principles within the lesson that's going to make for a more enjoyable and engaging lesson. And so that's why I put these out there. So I got an email from Stephanie, and this is regarding chapter 10 of the Ezra-Taft Benson manual. Many of you will remember that this is a recent one we had about flooding the earth with the Book of Mormon, that President Benson was famous for that talk. But she says, Stephanie says, "Thank you for having these great ideas and questions. I found them the morning of my lesson, and I had prepared it, but lacked a few things. I ended up doing the attention activity with Candy, which went well. I received lots of laughs, and it perfectly transitioned to a great discussion. I was also able to get a hold of missionaries and pull off having them bring 30 copies of the Book of Mormon to give to each sister in the class. It was a great lesson, one of my best, and I have you to thank. Thank you for these suggestions. Keep up the good work." So this is like payday for me when I get these emails and I hear that people are actually reading these things and they're applying them. Another one was the same lesson submitted by Steve, said, "Wow, what a great help for me when I was planning my lesson. Thanks so much for this. Not to mention it does help with flooding the earth with the Book of Mormon." Ha ha. And then there's another comment from Heather Meekham, who's been a guest on the Leading LDS Podcast for How I Lead segment. And she commented on President Richen Jones' interview when we did a How I Lead interview with him. And she says, "I agree so much with having a purpose for activities. As young women leader, it can be really hard to show up for weekly activities when people are simply filling a calendar, rather than looking at the needs around them and planning activities to meet them. When we plan with a purpose, people feel needed and that we respect their time. Thanks for another great podcast." So I appreciate those comments, and please keep them coming. Comment on the post, or you can just simply email me, and I'd love to share them. So now on to the topic of today. This is an interview I found a few years ago. It's about 3 years old. And The Economist, many of you have much bigger brains than me, may be familiar with this publication, but The Economist is a magazine, and obviously they have online platforms and interviews and YouTube channels and things like that. But this is an interview I found with where they interview Clay Christensen and last name Quigley, James Quigley. Now, these two were both featured in the Mormon Way of Doing Business book, came out years ago. I recommend it. It's interesting anyways. But they're both LDS leaders or past leaders. For example, James Quigley has served as a bishop. I'm sure he served in other callings. I'm just not as familiar with his background in the church. And Clayton Christensen has obviously served in many leadership callings, not only within the church, but also teaches at Harvard and is an author. Many of his books I've referenced, and they're fantastic. And he has been in Area 70. So I enjoyed listening to this interview because they solved business problems and leadership problems. And as I was listening to it, it made me wonder how they may maybe answer similar questions in the context of LDS leadership in regards to home teaching or creating change and influence and impacting culture in an organization. So I wanted to put this together and share with you some clips. I'll also share the full interview on Leading LDS. You can watch. It's about 30 minutes, and not all of it is applicable to LDS leadership, but if you have a business background, it is quite interesting. So as an Elders Quorum president, or maybe a Relief Society president, have you ever had a new idea for solving a problem that should be implemented immediately? It's such a good idea that you want to share it with your counselors, your organization, your quorum, whatever it is, and get this idea going because it's going to make a difference. Now, your new idea feels so profound, and when you share that idea, you see some initial excitement from maybe your counselors or others in the quorum. They buy into it, and they think it's a good idea. But then the meeting ends. Everybody goes home, gets back to life, maybe forgets about it a little bit, or they just get distracted. And over a few weeks, you see no lasting effect of that idea take hold, and you get frustrated. In reality, what you're trying to do with a new idea is change quorum culture, the way success happens. This is something we miss a lot as leaders. Sometimes we feel like we're just trying to fix a problem or trying to improve home teaching. But we have to step back and realize that this is a cultural problem. And if you're able to change and impact the culture of your quorum, the way things get done, the way things people expect them to be, the more likely it is that you're going to have change in home teaching, change in the quality of meeting, change in all aspects because you're changing the culture. So Clay Christensen, I want to play a clip from this interview, and he knows why this is usually difficult, this changing of or this application of new ideas. And so the Economist interviewer asks, what really changes culture in order to allow business to adapt to new innovation? Now, if Leading LDS was running the interview, I would have asked, what really changes culture in order to allow quorums to adapt to new home teaching innovation? Here's the clip.
I think I'm understanding the problem a little bit more. And that is, suppose I actually do come up with a very insightful point and imagine that I articulate it in a compelling way. Hmm. Well, on the other side, my idea is consumed individually and asynchronously. And so somebody, if I did my job, just goes to work on Monday morning, just energized about what this could do to this company, and pulls her team together and says, we're going to go in that direction, not this one. And they say, that makes no sense at all, because they didn't read it. And then 5 years later, one of them will inadvertently read it and then come back to the original one, and she forgot it. And as they try to convince everybody else to
do... So this is an argument that everyone should read your books, not just one person. As an author, I agree with that, by the way. All of you should read my books, too. Yes.
But somehow figuring out how to consume good ideas in a way that gives them a common language and a common way to frame the problem so they can reach consensus around a counterintuitive course of action.
Because almost as a foreign virus has entered a body, organizations will attack and kill disruptive ideas, won't they? Ones of the sort that you're advocating.
It's a general rule.
So, but I'm not. Even though you may be a great thinker and guru, I'm not going to let you off the hook. I want you to give us a positive example of what works. How do you overcome the problem you've identified in practice with the companies that you've advised or studied?
Well, there's some great examples. So we did a piece about how healthcare will become affordable and accessible if we bring technology so that lower-cost venues of care and lower-cost caregivers can do more sophisticated things. And Johnson & Johnson in Cincinnati figured out, holy cow, there are a lot of things that actually could be done in a doctor's office if we just had the technology that enable a nurse to apply anesthesia. And because you can't have an anesthesiologist hanging around your office all day long, sure, just in case somebody needs this stuff, you have to send this to the hospital where they do it at very high cost. And so Johnson & Johnson says, I bet you that we could get the algorithms inside of the anesthesiologists and put that in this box and just use Toprolol, an anesthesia that works in a minute and wears off in a minute on a continuous basis. And it makes it so affordable that a nurse can just monitor this thing because the monitoring is actually done by the machine. And it beats the anesthesiologist by a factor of 12.
So the shift in thinking here was traditionally they might have peddled this stuff at hospitals at high cost. They might have had to go against a business model that was quite profitable by actually finding a new way to reach their target audience.
That's right.
And I'm sure there were salesmen who didn't like this at first.
That's right. Yeah. But once you give them a language and a way to frame the problem,
right,
holy cow, the size of the market all of a sudden is very big as opposed to how small it was when it was targeted to the experts.
Right. All right, those not familiar with Clay Christensen, I should probably have warned you. He uses some pretty big words, all right? But nonetheless, he's fascinating to listen to. So he talks about this idea of when a leader or even a member of an organization has a new idea and wants to share that and apply it to them, right? And what happens is that people perceive that idea differently. And so as leaders, many times we feel like our job is to come up with great ideas, and our ideas can be applied because we're the leader. So what happens when a leader tries to pass on those ideas to his quorum or group? They're perceiving those ideas differently. They're not having the same influences that you're having as the leader. And I talk a little bit about this in my post about that the leader must come down to share their ideas. They have additional information. They have additional data that they must bring with them and share why the leader is so motivated in applying an idea because they have seen why something's not working, right? Many times as a leader, we'll have these disruptive ideas or an idea where we think, boy, this is going to work. This is going to make a difference. I just need to tell people about it, then they'll all jump on board. But a lot of these disruptive ideas are treated like a virus in an organization, like the interviewer mentions. New idea comes and people start to, they default to the reasons why this can't work. And so it does take a very methodical and deliberate path to share ideas and saying, this is why this can work, and being able to communicate and get feedback to make sure everybody is having has the common ideas straight, is speaking on a common language. So I don't mean to get too much in the weeds here, but the simple point is that good ideas aren't enough. You have to be able to build a skill as a leader to communicate those ideas in a way that everybody is in sync and receiving the ideas just like you received it as a leader. And that goes back to culture. It's not about the idea. It's not about the program. It's not about home teaching. It's about you impacting the culture of your quorum so that it's an innovative culture and people will more likely embrace these ideas and move forward with them. So now the question is, well, okay, how do you do that? Like, how can you effectively change culture? And this is when the interviewer goes to James Quigley, who answers this question. The economist asks the question, what do you think works in changing culture in this way? And what I would have asked if leading LDS was doing the interview is, what do you think works in changing culture in an elders quorum? Here's his response.
Jim, let's get your perspective on this. You've advised a lot of companies in this area. What do you think works in changing culture in this way? What are the real challenges?
Well, I think changing culture, and especially of a successful organization, is the biggest management challenge that anyone ever faces. I was fascinated by your opening this morning when you defined innovation as this fresh thinking that creates value, which I agree with, by the way. And
thank you.
When you think about trying to drive innovation and in a large, complex organization, how do you sustain both of those ideas? How do you sustain the idea of a constant stream of fresh thinking or new ideas, and at the same time have the discipline to be able to obtain the value And I think that is the reason that when you said, how many of you think innovation is a bad idea, and you were able to extract one hand,
right.
I suspect if I were to say, how many of you in your organizations have been able to take this idea that we universally said was a good one, and have you driven it deep into the fabric of the enterprise and it's part of your culture? And I suspect would see an equally few number of hands. And the reason for that, I believe, is there's just simply a paradoxical conflict of the structure and approach that's going to spawn new ideas conflicts with the discipline, hierarchy, and execution that is required to obtain value. And so one of the approaches, I think, and one of the metaphors perhaps we can use is this idea of perhaps the benevolent dictator. You need to be benevolent in order to allow the organization to believe that it's okay to question the status quo. But at a certain moment, you have to be a dictator to make a decision on what you're going to execute. But because those two ideas are so difficult to reconcile, I think it is really hard to drive it fundamentally into the core of the fabric and culture of an organization.
So the biggest management challenge is changing culture. And this is such a key principle. It seems so simple and maybe obvious once you hear it and say it. But going back to an elders quorum, just to use that world as an example, we get caught up in thinking this challenge of home teaching is so unique, or nobody can just figure this out. It's not improving. That's because you're probably focusing too much on the problem and not enough on the culture of your quorum, where these things naturally happen because you've done them. Okay. And it needs to be driven deep into the fabric of your organization, like he heard. And this anecdote of a benevolent leader, or benevolent dictator, is fantastic. And this can be very much applied in a ward council or in a presidency meeting, where you have to balance at one end being the leader that is obviously open to ideas and isn't just shutting down every idea that comes for them and telling them why that will never work, but being open that there's no bad ideas. But at the same time, on the other end of the spectrum, being the leader that's going to make a decision and saying, okay, I've heard all those ideas and they're great, and we're going to do this, and making sure it's not always just your idea that you do, but trying to be that benevolent leader and applying those ideas of other individuals in the group or quorum that are suggesting them, and then seeing if those will work. But you've got to, a lot of times we just default to benevolent, and oh, that's a great idea, and we nice everybody to death, right? And taking that at that moment to gather the information and then make a leader and say, this is what we're doing and this is how we're going to be disciplined about it, that's when the culture can be impacted and change can happen. All right, in this next clip, the question that leading LDS would ask, well, I guess the question the economist asked was, how can a manager kill a project that isn't going to work in order to be more effective as a company? But the real question that he answers in how I would ask it is, how can a leader make sure home teaching will be more effective? And this is what his response was.
When I die, and they're going to interview me outside of heaven to decide whether they're going to let me in, I'm going to start by saying, I got some questions for you first. And one of the questions is, why did you only make data available about the past? You orient us to the future. The evidence is from the past. And so what are we going to do?
Right.
You know? And there's an answer to that. And that is that if you don't think you can innovate unless you're guided by data. And we at the Harvard Business School, we just elevate the virtues of being fact-based and data-driven and analytical. We condemn people to do action after the game is over. And if they don't wait for that, then they need to go into the future and fail fast, because there's no way to look into the fog of the future. But I don't think that's true.
What's an alternative way to look at it?
If you have a theory, and the word theory gets a bad rap in amongst managers because it's associated with the word theoretical, which connotes impractical, right? But it's not true. A theory is a statement of causality, of what causes what and why. So just as an example, here I am. Clay Christensen, I'm sitting here. I have attributes. And you can correlate the fact that I have these characteristics and the propensity to buy a product. But that doesn't cause me to buy that product. It's correlative, not causal. What causes me to buy a product is, you know, stuff happens to me. Jobs arise in my life that I need to get done, and I hire products or services to get the job done. And what that means is, if you understand the job that the customer is trying to get done, mm-hmm. you can predict that if you make a product to do the job, they will hire it. And it's actually quite important, because if you think you need to understand the customer, it will misguide you. The customer is the wrong unit of analysis. What you need to understand is, what's the job that would cause her to buy this? And this is known in advance. This is why Jobs was so special, is he didn't use data. You know, he just kind of walked around trying to figure out, what are the jobs arising in their lives for which we might be able to develop a product that will help them get the job done more readily? And if you try to understand that, the probability of that you'll be successful isn't 100%, but it sure isn't a crapshoot.
Here's the reality. It's easy to default to data, especially when you're dealing with a problem like home or visiting teaching, right? You have the data of what's happened in the past, what companionships are doing well, what companionships are failing, and you see that percentage, right? And so you then approach the problem to fix the problem with that data in mind. But in reality, as leaders, again, going back to changing the culture, we need to get away from being a culture of being data-driven, even when you're not meaning it to be. And I'm not saying you're the type of leader that stands up and is always focusing on the numbers, numbers, numbers. Indirectly, you can be data-driven without really focusing a lot on the numbers, because you're basing all of your decisions as a leader on past data. When in reality, like Brother Christensen says here, you need to focus on what the problem is. Just like Steve Jobs walked around and looked for problems that people have that just need to be fixed, right? So it's important to help those people in your quorum not only understand the home teaching family, but you need to understand the needs and concerns in the life of that home teaching family that they can impact. And when those needs are paramount, then that's when motivation happens and solutions come to the surface. So for example, the need of a laid off father finding a job is more important than simply making a monthly visit. The home visit many times is classified as the need, when in reality, they don't need a visit. They don't need somebody in their living room. They just need a short 10-minute visit so they can get back to enjoying the evening with their children. Maybe that's all they need. When approaching home teaching this way, the probability that you will be successful isn't 100%, but it sure isn't a crapshoot when you're solving problems and not just making visits. That can have a cultural impact that motivates people. They see, well, I really am making a difference because we've identified a problem. Now, the hard part sometimes isn't identifying a problem people have. Some people, their problem is obvious, that the home teaching families that are on the elders list, those problems may be obvious, whether they have failing health or they are looking for a job. But sometimes it is realizing the problem isn't that big and not overwhelming that family or patron with so many visits and wanting to do this or that, but recognizing that they just need someone to touch base, maybe through a phone call, some relief site to send a letter. And sometimes that's all that sister or family needs in order to feel needed and home taught or whatever it is. And then down the road, because of that contact being made, the major problems that may surface are obvious, and then the home teacher can take action at that point. So that can be a huge cultural shift, is going from not just a group of brethren and sisters that make visits, but a group of brethren and sisters that identify problems and fix problems and recognize when there's no problem to fix and not try to fix a problem that doesn't exist. But I encourage you to check out these videos. I know it's really easy to get in the weeds of these things and theory and business theory, and I'm not trying to, push home teaching and visiting teaching in this box that just doesn't fit. And maybe I am a little bit, but I think we can learn a lot from the research and perspective of these men, especially these men that have a perspective in their life of the church and the problems that many quorums face. And a lot of these problems, again, changing culture is a problem that's dealt with in the secular world, and it's a problem that's dealt with in the church world. And so I don't mean to get in the weeds too much, but maybe listen to these clips a few times. I'll post the full interview if you want the full context on Leading LDS with this podcast recording. But I hope it's helpful, and I hope it's maybe get you thinking in a different way. And maybe I've missed something in the approach here, and I'd love your feedback and comments of what did you take away from these clips? What can we learn about changing culture and applying new ideas in a quorum that's going to better help us lead and find success that we're praying for? Until next time, be a leader and not a calling.